Hey, Get Your Fresh Bizcast here. I'm DC Dennison. This week, reporter Sasha Talca talks to Red Sox Chief Operating Officer Mike D, the man behind many of the team's big business ideas.
So why don't we start by having you tell us a little bit about your role with the team and also with Fenway Sports Group, and give us an overview of Fenway Sports Group.
Okay, well, with the Red Sox, I'm the Chief Operating Officer, which entails mostly the business activities of the club, which would include, all sales and marketing and Fenway Park operations, the Fenway Enterprises business, which is what we call our non-game event business, accounting and finance, human resources, pretty much the full breadth of the business side of the Red Sox. Work very closely, obviously, on all those things with Larry Lucchino, our CEO, and with others on our senior management team. The Red Sox are a pretty big operation in baseball standards because of the popularity of the franchise, the fact that we do operate our own facility, not only our own facility here in Boston, but also our spring training facility in Fort Myers, Florida, falls under my responsibility as well. So that's pretty active, especially this time of year, a pretty big part of our business, as you know, from last year. The Fenway Sports Group side is the president of Fenway Sports Group, which was a new company created that is a sister company to both the Red Sox and to Nesson. And Fenway Sports Group is basically charged with looking for new entrepreneurial ventures in sports and sports-related activities. The company is almost 2 years old, and we now have 12 full-time employees and about 40 part-timers at various points in time of the year. And that part of our business is growing every day.
Mm-hmm. On the Fenway Sports Group side, what are some of the ventures that you've looked at previously, and what are the things you're looking at in the future?
We've looked at a variety of different professional sports opportunities, including arena football, Major League Soccer, other tennis ventures, and event-related sort of sports opportunities. What we've really focused our business on is to really try to develop relationships and own marquee properties, what we consider to be tier one sort of marquee properties. And our proudest accomplishment here locally is a relationship we have with Boston College. Boston College joined the Atlantic Coast Conference this year, and it was a great first year in all the fall sports, including men's football and girls soccer. Had a great year, their first year in the ACC. Now we've moved into the winter sports, where we have men's and women's basketball. And it's just been a great relationship, both from a commercial standpoint. I think we've been able to really make a difference in the operation there. But also, it's fun to see that level of collegiate competition come to Boston. This is a conference that is heralded around the country as being one of the strongest. BC did very well in its first football year in the conference, finished tied for their particular division with Florida State, and got a bid to the MPC Computers Bowl in Boise, Idaho, and won that game. So it's a very successful program that they built there, and we have a great relationship with Gene DeFilippo, the athletic department there. And finally, worth noting is our own kind of homegrown company, Fan Photo, which people may be familiar with if they've come to Fenway Park. This year, we launched it at Wrigley Field in Chicago. And it is now a very successful little enterprise on its own. It's a digital online photo gallery of fans in the stands, where you have your photo taken, you log on to that club's website, and you can buy that photo in the form of a print or a coffee mug or a calendar. It's been very successful. The Cubs just renewed us for Wrigley Field for 2006. And looking actively at expanding that business as well. So we continue to look at a variety of different new ventures along the way, including media assets, various other professional sports, including racing and other things that we have an interest in, and more to follow on that front.
You also at one point looked at NASCAR, right?
We did, and we continue to. We think NASCAR is a great sport. Its popularity is undeniable. The media deals that were just recently done with ABC and ESPN, and you see it becoming certainly more mainstream every day. If you talk to the NASCAR folks, they call it mainstream now. I think the regionality of it is a thing of the past. It is a national force, not just in the Southeast, but everywhere. And we think that if you're going to be in the sports business, having an interest in NASCAR is something that, a company of FSG's nature should be actively looking at and monitoring.
Now, when you say you're looking at an interest, what is that? I mean, you probably looked at all variety of different deals, but what does that mean, an interest?
It could be in the form of a team. We looked at teams. We looked at online assets. Nothing specific. I think that as we go out and learn more about other sports, we see opportunities. And, the basis of FSG was to use the strength and resources of our parent company, which exists around both the Red Sox and NESN, to look for other opportunities to grow. These are all incremental opportunities. None of the things that we're doing with FSG come at the expense of resources or time that is taken away from the Red Sox or from NESN. This is a new frontier, if you will, that we're trying to build. We think it makes the parent company of the Red Sox and NESN much more well-rounded and diversified. And so whether you're looking at online assets or you're looking at investing in a team or in a league or in a television network or in a radio network, all those opportunities are of interest for us to look at. There's not to use a NASCAR metaphor, but there's not a tire we haven't kicked.
That brings to my next question, which is, what are the Red Sox? I mean, why did the Red Sox have such an interest in all these other sports properties? Why?
Well, I think that it's first of all, it's sort of the entrepreneurial nature of our partnership. We have a terrific ownership group led by John Henry and Tom Werner, but we also have a strong group of limited partners, all of whom come from entrepreneurial backgrounds. We also have terrific people resources here. We're very fortunate to have very good depth in our organization. And remember that a baseball team is only as good as its front office. The players on the field win games and lose games, but a front office that has a vision, not just on the baseball side, but on the business side, and has a vision as to how that franchise is going to be run on and off the field, is one that, if you look around the league, whether it's baseball or football or basketball, the best franchises that have success on the field or on the court are usually oftentimes the best franchises off the field or off the court. So we've been very careful to try to build a tier one front office. And in the course of doing that, we've been fortunate to attract some very talented people that, you're always looking for ways for them to grow. And, fortunately, we have the blessing of ownership to go out and to look to pursue some of these opportunities. We're going to be very selective. We have, our core business is and will always be the Red Sox, and that'll always be, the primary focus, whether it pertains to FSG or to NESN. I mean, the Red Sox are at the center of the mantelpiece for NESN as well, and certainly that's the case with Fenway Sports Group. But, to the extent that we can be selective and look for those opportunities that fit kind of the criteria that we've established for diversifying our sports interests to some degree, then we're going to be aggressive in pursuing those opportunities.
What are some of the other teams that you admire in terms of their front office capabilities and their business savvy?
Well, certainly close to home, the Patriots are, on and off the field have really established a great tradition of excellence here. And, the Boston sports scene is very fortunate to have great ownership, I think, in many of the, all of the professional teams that exist here. And having known personally all the people involved, I can say that it's a great sports city. And virtually everybody here wants to win and do the right thing. That isn't the case in every city. So, I think if you're a fan of the Boston teams, feel good about the fact that you got competitive people, I think, who want to do the right thing and put a competitive team on the field. you look around baseball, you know, you see teams that have been heralded for, you know, community involvement. You know, certainly we like to try to strive to be active participants in the community. We think that is a major fundamental, you know, commitment that a sports team has. And, you know, there are great teams around the country that have done well with that. They're great individual athletes. I mean, you look at the Tiger Woods Foundation benefiting so many different kids. Andre Agassi has done a great job, you know, in Las Vegas and in many of the things that he's involved with. So, you know, we look at what other teams do and we try to model some of what we do after what they do. But Boston and New England is a unique place. And so we have to also do things that I think are specific to our regionality. You know, if all we did was to, you know, focus solely on Boston, you know, we'd be ignoring the other six states that are, you know, consider themselves in the core Red Sox nation. So it's a big challenge and one that, you know, Meg Valancourt and our foundation and all the people that work in our community relations area, you know, do a great job and focus on.
Now you mentioned briefly, I think, media bias you were interested in. Are you interested in owning a radio station or several radio stations?
You know, I think that, again, we look at each opportunity as they present themselves. We have a terrific radio partner right now with Entercom and WEEI, and, you know, we're in the process of looking to extend that relationship, or, you know, our radio rights are completed after the 2006 season. This contract is up, and, you know, I think that we're in the process of weighing those options now, but we've been very fortunate to have a great partnership with WEEI. I wouldn't preclude anything. I think that, you know, we look at opportunities all the time, and, you know, the radio business has been a changing business. You've had satellite radio, you've had terrestrial radio, you have digital radio coming on board. AM radio is going to go through big changes in the next 5 years as they move to digital quality sound. So I think we're going to, you know, go into the process with open eyes and you know, look to do something that's in the best interest of the Red Sox.
One experiment that you tried was with you. I know you hate the word, but you auctioned off those seats in the back of the field. How did that work?
Yeah, it went well, actually. The fans that purchased the experience, as we call it, not the seats, really enjoyed the atmosphere, the VIP treatment that they received. You know, the seats and access to the ballpark, especially at that time of year, it was the last 16 games of last year. Certainly that was the core of the offer. But we also wanted to do things for Red Sox Nation. You know, we started this kind of quasi fan club last year where you could sign up for Red Sox Nation citizenship. And we tried to sprinkle the program throughout the year with all types of special offers and benefits, which included a trip to Cooperstown to see us play, you know, an exhibition game before the Hall of Fame weekend. We had road trips to other ballparks. We had an organized road trip to Toronto. We had special opportunities to buy merchandise. And we decided that given the demand for tickets and the fact that we were sold out in a pennant race last year, that we would create this special experience called the Nation's Nest that was outside. We didn't take any existing seats. We just took, you know, space that was in the ballpark, that was standing room space, and kind of converted it to this area. And it was a tremendous success. And, you know, certainly one that we're going to look to expand the Red Sox Nation program. I'm not quite sure where that type of access fits into the mix. We're still working through those details for 2006, but you know, we had 50,000 members in our first year of Red Sox Nation, 50,000 card carrying citizens, and I think that you know, we've been the response has been overwhelmingly positive. You know, let's do it again. You know, where do I sign up for 2006? So we're going to be announcing details of that program shortly.
50,000 in your first year. And what's, for the Red Sox, the benefit of Red Sox Nation besides the $10 fee that people pay? And why are you interested in that?
Yeah, you know, fans are, it's very important in our world, by our lights, to look at the current phenomenon around, you know, Fenway Park and Red Sox baseball. And, you know, right now we're still in a position based on the early sales activity for 2006 where we have, you know, probably two buyers for every seat. You know, the demand for tickets. We have a season ticket waiting list. You know, there are many people who would like to feel the affinity to the club who may not, unfortunately, have access to tickets. And so actually Red Sox Nation, like many good ideas or most good ideas, actually evolved out of a suggestion from a fan who said, you know, what if there was a way where, you know, I can't get, you know, this particular fan actually lived outside the marketplace, you know, and said, you know, I don't live in Boston, but I'd love to, you know, to feel like I'm a member of Red Sox Nation in a more formal way. You know, like I log on to RedSox.com all the time. How can I get special information and news and offers and opportunities? And how can I find out about that trade, you know, before it happens? And how can I, you know, participate in online chat with your general manager or your star player? So we're all about whether it's the way that we try to operate Fenway Park or through a program like Red Sox Nation, trying to be warm and fuzzy. You know, people that are fans of the Red Sox have an intense passion for the team, the history. You know, we always say we are stewards of this team. You know, we don't really own it. The fans in New England own the Red Sox. We're just fortunate to be in a position to steer the ship for the time that we're all fortunate to be here. So I think we have an obligation to find ways to unlock the door, to let people in and have people feel like they're part of our immediate family. You know, if Fenway was 70,000 seats, we could probably sell 70,000 tickets, who knows, but we can't do that. So Red Sox Nation is a way that allows people to have a special affinity and special access to things that are associated with the club without necessarily having tickets to Fenway Park.
So in terms of the Nation's Nest, the auction seats, do you remember the highest price that you got for one?
Oh, you know, I don't. I believe we were selling them in four packs. I can get you that offline if you want. It's, but I believe it was in the neighborhood of $400 or $450 in that range. I think actually one of the Yankee games I thought brought maybe a little more than that, maybe upwards to close to $550. But, you know, again, this was about walking on the field before batting practice. This was about, you know, getting a t-shirt, having a private concierge, and having your picture taken up on top of the green monster before the game. So while the tickets were a big part of it, I think it's inaccurate to suggest that we sold tickets for $600. I think people would have paid nearly that much just to have the ability to do some of the other things that they did, frankly. And that's what we heard from our fans. Our fans were like, wow, could you do more cool stuff like this? Unfortunately, you know, you can't expand it because you would lose its personality if you did it with 200 fans. You know, I think we had 10 or 12 tickets up there per game, and it was perfect. It was a perfect size group, and you know, we had, I think Jerry Remy stopped by one game and said hi. You know, it was really a special kind of unique thing.
So would you consider adding more seats in this kind of program or a similar kind of program, but you know, letting prices be set on the open market versus set by the Red Sox?
You know, maybe. I think that, you know, the dilemma that you face when you have this sort of demand scenario is that you have a huge secondary marketplace out there. And, you know, the question is if you subscribe to dynamic pricing, and dynamic pricing defined as let the buyer decide how much the ticket's worth, you know, there may well be a price reduction in some of the seats that are ultimately used. I mean, right now, the licensed authorized resellers who are operating in Massachusetts and New England and doing it, you know, legally under the cover of the law, are selling seats at, you know, 6 to 7 to 8 times face value, depending upon the time of year and the opponent. And, you know, we monitor that market. We don't participate in it. We do give our season ticket holders an authorized club solution for reselling their tickets, which we call Red Sox Replay. That's at face value, but plus a nominal service fee that people pay on the buy side, not the sell side. So, you know, the secondary ticket market, if you assume that, you know, depending upon the time of year, that maybe 1 in 5 Red Sox tickets are resold for a summertime game against a good opponent, the question is if there were more seats available to dynamic pricing, would that in effect serve to lower the cost and sort of deflate the secondary market. We don't know, but we're going to continue to monitor it. And, you know, we work very closely with the Attorney General's office on trying to deal with scalping issues, both online and over the phone. And around Fenway Park. You know, they as recently as the postseason last year for the Yankee series in September last year, we had active dialogue with them, making sure that we were doing everything we could to deflate, you know, the secondary market. You know, we've taken great steps, which I won't go into all the detail of, to try to make sure that tickets get into the hands of those who will use them. Included in that is placing limits on number of tickets that people can buy, trying to incorporate total, complete, random, you know, sort of chance into the process so that you can't sleep out for four nights. And, you know, when we got here, there were people that were paid to sleep out and be at the front of the line to buy hundreds of tickets for scalpers. And, you know, we changed that policy immediately. And I think we've made progress. I think, you know, we hear from fans. When you look around Fenway Park, you see many more families, you see many more kids. And our hope is that the steps that we've taken to get tickets directly into the hands of the people who intend to use the ticket have contributed to that. But it is a big, big issue. You know, it's one that the Red Sox alone can't tackle, you know, the secondary ticket issue. And it's not only a Red Sox issue, it's concerts. You know, I know the AG's office last year was looking at the U2 tickets, you know, that were at the Fleet Center. This is a very high demand marketplace for premium events.
The state, I think, is currently weighing changes to the laws around scalping. Do you guys have any particular opinions one way or the other about that?
We participated last year in a bipartisan panel that took, you know, testimony on that or wanted to solicit input. And, you know, the only thing we asked for was, you know, to level the playing field, so to speak, to give us the opportunity to continue to take steps to ensure that fans were, you know, who were buying the tickets were actually intending to use the tickets. You know, there's a bigger issue now with the advent of new technologies and barcoding tickets and printing tickets at home on your computer. You know, the paper ticket used to be the way of the world. Pretty soon your ticket's going to be on your PDA, and you're just going to walk up and hold it in front of a barcode, and it's going to read it off of your cell phone or your personal electronic device. And all of that creates new challenges operationally. You know, that if you, an example would be if somebody buys a ticket on the street and the barcode's already been used. You know, we don't tear tickets. Barcode's been used. Well, you know, that person may look at that ticket. It looks like a ticket. Beautiful ticket. It's authentic. But somebody's already entered the park with it, passed it back out through the gate. Now somebody's out on the street selling it. So, you know, that type of buyer beware. Consumers need to know that if they're buying on the street or through unauthorized sources, they run the risk that could be a ticket that is not valid, even if it's a legitimate Red Sox ticket, not a counterfeit ticket. So, you know, all those new challenges, I think that as you get into laws that will kind of create, you know, the environment or the way that secondary ticket activity will be managed, you know, the only thing I think we ask for is the hope that all of those considerations are taken into, you know, all those factors are taken into consideration, because it is not the same issue that it was in 1980, and it won't be the same issue in 2020 that it is in 2006.
Mm-hmm. A while back, you guys were looking at perhaps ice skating at Fenway Park. What happened to that?
Well, we decided to postpone our interest in doing that for at least a year while we are undergoing the most extensive renovation of Fenway Park and its storied history. So the ballpark is largely under construction this offseason. Many of the utilities have been shut off, and it's just not a place where you would want a lot of fans moving around safely right now, you know, without hard hats and what a normal construction zone would look like. So we have, we continue to be interested in that. We continue to be interested in other events at Fenway. We put a bid in 2 months ago that we made another presentation to recently to the Atlantic Coast Conference to host the 2007 ACC baseball tournament here. We've made it very clear that we would love to use Fenway in a prudent fashion beyond baseball. And I say prudent fashion because obviously we're part of a neighborhood, so we need to do it in conjunction with our neighbors and especially with the city. City's been terrific in cooperating with us on the concerts that we've had here. The neighborhood's been very supportive in the things that we've done here, and we've tried to take the faith that they placed in us to do these events in the right way and not do every one that comes down the pike. We're trying to be very selective and do only those events that really fit sort of what we think is the historic significance and charm of Fenway. And whether or not we do outdoor hockey and skating here remains to be seen. It's clearly something that we're interested in looking at, though. And the thought of a college doubleheader here, in November with local schools playing other college hockey programs on the national scene would sure be of interest. But we'd have to go to the city, and we'd have to go to the neighbors and make sure that everybody was on board.
Hey, one thing you're doing is you're having a minor league game here. That's the first time.
Yeah,
I think.
Mayor Menino had that idea, and we're excited to have it. I think it's going to be good for fans. And I'm sorry I cut you off, but
I was just going to say it's in August of next year.
Yeah, August of next year, and we're going to have Lowell and Pawtucket playing here, which is our single A and triple A franchises. And the mayor has been very cooperative with us and very supportive of trying to do ways to, again, to make Fenway warm and fuzzy, open it up to the public, give opportunities for fans to, come to see a game here or experience Fenway in a way that, a Red Sox game may not present that same opportunity because of the demand for tickets. So this is a direct outgrowth of his vision and those discussions, and it may be a new tradition. We'll see how it goes, and tickets are going to be, we haven't announced all the details yet, but tickets will be dramatically less expensive than the Red Sox tickets will be. And we hope to, we're making the concerted effort to just not sell them to, the Red Sox ticket holders. We're going to try to sell them on the kind of a single game basis to give as many fans as possible the chance to see baseball here and hopefully see the Red Sox stars of the future.
And when fans come in for opening day this year, what changes will they see in terms of seating to the ballpark?
Whoa. Big changes. First and foremost, that reflection off of the glass that was in front of the 406 Club, which was formerly known as the 600 Club, is gone. And the new area the new areas, I should say, that encompass that space are the EMC Club and the Home Plate Pavilion Club. Also the roof box sections down the first and third base lines have been replaced by a new structure, which has a brand new concourse behind it on each side. So we've been able to dramatically increase the number of seats. I think we have 1,200 incremental tickets this year as a result of these changes. And I think a dramatically better looking ballpark aesthetically. And people are going to look at where that glass used to be and say, do you remember they used to have glass there? I just think this is going to be, for Fenway historians who really, are in love with the ballpark, as we are, we just think that these changes are going to be very well received. The one comment that really drives our passion for Fenway Park, and it's Larry Lucchino and Janet Marie Smith who are really at the forefront of this, is, when people say, boy, I looked out at those green monster seats and they look like they've always been there. Or I look out at the right field roof seats and they look like they've always been there. I think people are going to say the same thing about this year's changes as well. And, we have been, we've been very, very fortunate to have the guidance and the input from our fans who have driven many of these changes over the first 4 years. Fans said, we need wider concourses. Fans said, what if you could make Yawkey Way part of Fenway? All these things that have come, inbound, and we've been able to capitalize on that input and to make Fenway Park a better place, not just a bigger place, which is key, but a better place. Everybody that I run around, I go around the country in my business travels, say, well, you're really adding on to Fenway. I was like, we really haven't added that many seats. We've just made it a lot more comfortable. And, the creature comforts of today's ballpark and the demands that fans have today, because they've been to Gillette or they've been to the you know, the TD Bank North Garden here in Boston, or they've visited Camden Yards or other new ballparks in the baseball world, they have a higher level of expectation, both in terms of what amenities are offered and the way that they're treated and service. And, you know, that's the challenge for us, is to take what is the charm and intimacy of Fenway, don't lose that, but incorporate some of these creature comforts that make the ballpark more enjoyable by today's standards.
So if I'm sitting in one of those new seats in the EMC Club, what is my experience?
It's experience is going to be, we hope, among the best club-level experiences in all of baseball. It's going to be waiter-waitress service to your seat. These are the closest club seats, among the closest club seats to home plate in all of Major League Baseball. There's you know, just under 400 seats directly behind home plate. You know, there'll be a nice restaurant and lounge with an open kitchen and a bar area behind there. The seats are going to be comfortable. You know, the services that you're offered will be second to none in terms of standards in sports. Mm-hmm. So the other important thing with these newer seats, and as you talk about the changes at Fenway, we're really trying to use the seats that we're adding to reshape and rescale the way that we approach our pricing and sort of our marketing and sales activities. You know, Fenway is the smallest ballpark, remains the smallest ballpark in all Major League Baseball. The pricing pressure that has been placed on Fenway because of that fact over the last 10 years is well documented. You know, the grandstand seat that used to cost X now costs X plus. And, you know, we've done our best over the last 4 years to try to slow down that price growth. And the last 2 years, you know, the majority of the tickets either stayed the same or just went up a dollar, and that's been our commitment. But we think that by incorporating some of these new club seat areas, we're going to be able to sort of rescale and reshape the house, putting, you know, more or taking a lot of the pressure off, you know, the seats that are currently $30 or less, and trying to remove the pressure and the need to, you know, increase those tickets at the same percentage increase as the last 10-year average, as suggested, was the practice. And, you know, I think that, you know, so even if you're not sitting in the EMC Club or the Pavilion Club or one of the new seats, and you're a fan of the Red Sox and you come to Fenway Park, those seats are good for the Red Sox fans, because I think that you'll see a much different approach to pricing moving forward.
Are you going to make any seats cheaper as a result of adding these?
We have not reduced prices, but we held the prices this year, I believe, on 50% of the seats. You know, we are looking, as we look to kind of phase two of the what we're calling the pavilion level expansion, looking at, as we go down, you know, by first and third base, looking at incorporating some additional non-club seats. You know, right now, this year, of the 1,200 tickets added, I believe roughly 750 are club seats, and about 500 are not club tickets. You know, we have the new pavilion box level; those are not club seats. You know, that don't have club amenities. So it's a balance. You know, Fenway was in addition to being the smallest ballpark, was the most underserved from a premium seat standpoint. There were no premium seats other than the 600 club. When we arrived in 2002, we added the two rows of dugout seats before the 2002 season. We finished that project before the 2003 program or season and extended those down the line. And now with the 406 club being renovated and turned into these two areas, we really have kind of the first ever club level section of Fenway Park. But if you look at the percentage of club seats at Fenway compared to the percentage of club seats at other ballparks, we are still dramatically below the league average. And I think it's going to stay that way. That's just part of the charm and intimacy of Fenway. It should stay that way.
Okay, I think that's it. That gets us through.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to check in next week for another BizCast, or better yet, subscribe to get BizCast automatically delivered to your computer or portable digital device.